Chapter 31. My second brush with the work of Osama bin Laden was in Bali a year after 9/11. Two bombs, planted by Islamic extremists connected to bin Laden, exploded in crowded tourist areas of this lovely Indonesian island, and more than 200 were killed, most of them Western holidaymakers, and most of them under 30. Once again, at a few hours' notice, I found myself on a plane. I was sitting next to some rather bulky men. I thought possibly they were from special forces. In fact, we didn't speak the whole way, although I guessed that we were all flying east for the same reason. I assumed they thought I was a tourist or a reporter. However, when there was no one to meet me at Denpasar Airport, they noticed this and turned to me by the luggage carousel for the first time. "Want a lift, Doc? How did you know who I am? We guessed you must be the pathologist just by looking at you. How? Well, for a start, you didn't laugh at the movie. That's pathologist for you. Miserable, death-obsessed, dour-faced butchers. But I was grateful for the lift. And the first person I saw at the hotel was Coroner Alison Thompson, who happened to have been staying in Hong Kong and had flown directly here, knowing, again, that the British bodies would fall under her jurisdiction when they arrived at Heathrow. We greeted each other warmly, and although it was early morning in Bali, decided to set off for the hospital where the bodies were being stored. Before leaving London, I had been told that I was simply viewing the operation from the British point of view. But when I walked into the mortuary, the other pathologists, mostly Australians, but also Dutch and Germans, recognised me from international meetings we'd all attended, and immediately handed me a gown, an apron, some rubber gloves and a knife, and said, "Get on with it, Dick." The British embassy staff had done an amazing job of locating the British bodies. Not only that, they had found the fuel to keep the generator going of one of the few chilled containers in the whole place, if not the whole country. In fact, as with all disasters, we pathologists just worked a conveyor belt system of postmortems, taking whichever body came next, whatever the nationality. The problem was lack of facilities for the dead in a world of intense heat. I will never forget the sight or the smell of the bodies laid out in the shade, covered with bags of ice cubes from the supermarket. How I longed to find a lorry full of ice, which we could tip all over them. They were changing fast, and not for the better. Many were already fragmented, and identification was the usual jigsaw challenge, only made more complex by the untrained recovery teams, who just threw everything they found in one area into one bag. It was a great relief to come across an isolated hand wearing a wedding ring which was engraved on the inside with the name of its bearer. It was a small, tragic item, and it gave us one small piece of the tragic puzzle. Most of the victims who had been attracted to that sybaritic island were young and beautiful. They had been enjoying themselves in the bar or nightclub where the two bombs exploded, one after the other. The bombs were planted by an extremist group believed to be funded by Al-Qaeda. Eventually, it was confirmed that there were 28 British fatalities and that overall more than 200 people were injured and 202 were killed. It was a hard, exhausting and traumatic time. I have subsequently visited the memorials to this atrocity both in London and in Perth, Western Australia, but no memorial is necessary to remind me of the decaying bodies, the ice, the smell, the single dripping tap in the mortuary that was our water supply, and the overarching sense of the futility of terrorism. I'm not sure it has ever really left me. Back home, my working life was feeling insecure. The world of forensic pathology was changing, and we were now threatened by new uncertainties of a sort the great Simpson never had to face. The university medical schools had always paid us to lecture in our subject, but they decided, almost all of them, one by one, that now they would not continue funding or teaching forensic pathology. The main reason they gave was lack of forensic research and lack of publication in prestigious scientific journals. However, we were too busy with postmortems and coroners and courts to meet these new benchmarks of a good university. The age of intellectual evaluation through research assessment exercise had arrived, and we forensic pathologists were found wanting. Gradually, medical schools with great traditions of forensic pathology closed down departments and it wasn't long after Ian West's death that his kingdom at Guy's disappeared. St. George's hung on a bit longer, but my new department's warrant for execution had been signed. We had essentially been privatised. From now on, instead of providing forensic services for free, our salaries paid by the universities at which we taught, we would directly bill the police, coroners or defence solicitors for payment. I knew that, without a salary, it would be hard to continue with some necessary but unpaid work. I'm talking about public work, like my ongoing contribution to teaching the authorities safe restraint methods, and my participation in disaster planning. Everyone else at the group was salaried by the police or some other organisation. I no longer had the weight of a university behind me. Not only was the regular income gone, so were lectures and so were students, except at just a few specialist centres outside London. I had only ever lectured to packed halls and knew how interesting medical students found forensic work. I also felt that at least the rudiments of forensic medicine should be an important part of their training. Every doctor, no matter what their discipline, should be able to identify the signs of suspicious circumstances so that they would know when to call an expert or the police. But there was too much real medicine competing for too little space in the training schedules, and forensic pathology now became accessible only on specialist postgraduate courses at few universities. I set up a group called Forensic Pathology Services, widely known as FPS, through which pathologists in London and the southeast of the UK would operate in our brave new privatised world. And suddenly, while I was buried deep in its planning and organisation, I realised that I might not want to be a part of it. With a heavy heart, I had dropped Anna off that autumn at university. She had finally decided to study medicine. So they were gone now, both of our children, to the north of England. Of course they still needed us, but not in the same way. Our house seemed large and empty and quiet. Was that why we were spending more and more time on the Isle of Man? That home was nearer the children than London. Was it because, as my lectureship duties at St. George's were being wound down, there was little to keep us here? Was it because we loved our cottage on the island and wanted to support Jen's now widowed mother? Not that Maggie had let widowhood stand in the way of her social life, and in fact were now, ourselves, becoming part of her whirl. Or was my work in London beginning to weary me? Weary me so much that even flying on Friday afternoons could not restore me. Every court appearance seemed to turn into a bruising scrap, and sometimes I felt I lacked the resilience to cope with it. There was no longer a bounce in my step when the police called me to another crime, another body. I had given up hope that they would ever phone me for my opinion on a case, and, looking into the future, I could see that pathologists eventually could be tendering for contracts, competing for bodies, even undercutting each other on price. Forensic pathology was a service, but no longer the intellectually rigorous world I had entered, with its scope for debate, study, and social change. Jen had become disillusioned with her work too. Despite her amazing feat in becoming a doctor so late in life, once she was practicing as a GP, she found she did not really want to be one. She had always been keen for us to move to the Isle of Man, and believed that here she could practice her own specialisation, dermatology, and live in the place she wanted to be. What else pushed us there? Our knowledge of our own senescence? A longing for the lifestyle Maggie and Austin had enjoyed? A hope that, if we spent more time isolated together on an island, somehow the loving communication which was missing would suddenly reappear? Perhaps I, and perhaps Jen too, was having that thing people call a midlife crisis, which no pathologist has ever been able to locate within the human body, not even under a microscope. But when I was asked to write the 12th edition of Simpson's Forensic Medicine, the third edition of which you may remember had lured me into this profession, the invitation felt like a huge honour, and an excuse. So I was midwife too, but did not remain with the new forensic pathology services. Instead, Jen and I left London for good. We gave up the tidy hedges and neatly mown lawns of Surrey for a windswept and beautiful cottage on an island somewhere off Liverpool. I was generally believed by my colleagues and contemporaries to have completely lost my marbles. I was very happy and busy renovating the cottage, We went walking for miles over wild and windy moorland under big, big skies that were sometimes so clear we could see across the water to where the mountains of Mourne sweep down to the sea. We sat by the fire while gales whistled outside, or we just stared across the fields to the ocean as it conjured up dramatic storms from its depths. I did not carry out a single post-mortem. And here we had a social life. We had always been too busy for this before, but now we had friends. It mattered little that we were much younger than most of them. We simply slotted into the society that had been ready-made for us by Maggie. So what if she was aging a little now? She was still at every party, a woman with haute couture dresses bulging from every wardrobe in almost every bedroom in the house. Something delicious bubbling on the stove, a gin and tonic always at the ready, and she was never without an admiring circle of friends. It felt good to be among them, good to be part of a community. The children visited often. For me, there may have been no more post-mortems, but there was lots of interesting work. I was writing my textbook on forensic pathology. I flew myself to the mainland to sit on committees for the British Association of Forensic Medicine, who were still sorting out Home Office contracts and many other details of the new privatised landscape. I was asked to give opinions on complex cases. I was busy on several ministerial working groups, devising and promoting more humane methods of restraint. Of course, I kept an eye on all interesting developments in my field. I learned that the police had reopened the inquiry into Rachel Nickell's murder. They now, finally, began to accept that someone other than Colin Stagg might have killed her. It took another 6 years for developments in DNA testing to nail Robert Napper for her death, the man who had murdered Samantha Bissett so violently and who was already detained in Broadmoor for life. I recalled carrying out the second post-mortem on Samantha Bissett's mutilated body, and I remembered saying to the detective how much I was reminded of Rachel Nickell's murder. I wished now that I hadn't simply made a passing remark, but said something more forceful, more questioning, more insistent. There was also a major development in the case of Sally Clark, the mother convicted of killing her two baby sons. She seemed to be planning a second appeal. She had been in jail for over 2 years now, but this appeal would be based on new evidence, new pathological evidence. The results of tests performed on blood and tissue samples taken from her second child had been discovered. The pathologist had not revealed this evidence before. In the view of some experts, but certainly not all, it showed that the second child might have died naturally of a bacterial staphylococcal infection. The Court of Appeal's job was to assess whether, if the jury had been in possession of this information at the time of the trial, it might reasonably have affected their decision to convict. The three judges decided that it might, and that therefore the conviction was unsafe. In 2003, Sally Clark, by that time a broken alcoholic, was released from jail. She died 4 years later. Sir Roy Meadow, the man who produced the extraordinary statistic that there was a 1 in 73 million chance of two children from the same family dying naturally, was publicly discredited. A number of the other mothers he had given evidence against and who were serving sentences now launched successful appeals. His maths was challenged by statisticians, and he was struck off by the General Medical Council. He later, much later, won his appeal against being struck off, but by then he was over 70. One piece of bad, off-the-cuff maths in court under intense cross-examination was a sad ending to a previously highly distinguished career. The pathologist, he who had examined both babies, changed his cause of death in one of them, and apparently withheld test results, was found guilty by the GMC of serious misconduct. He was suspended from carrying out Home Office post-mortems for 18 months. David Southall had been a commentator on, rather than a direct participant in, the Clark brothers' case, but Sally Clark's release now catalysed the inevitable backlash against his views and against the growing child protection movement. He may have furthered our understanding of the medical and moral complexities of infant mortality in general, and SIDS in particular, but angry pressure groups were formed by parents under suspicion and others who sympathised with them. And don't we all sympathise with the outrage of those who claim to have been unjustly accused? The groups complained to the GMC about Professor Southall. The GMC took their protests to its Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service. He was judged unfit to practice and struck off. It took him many years and a Court of Appeal decision to overturn this verdict. His condemnation by the GMC received wide coverage. His subsequent complete exoneration went almost unreported. The Sally Clark case perhaps charts the history of our relationship with SIDS. Fashions in thinking should have no place in the world of scientific truth, but they certainly do. 10 years earlier, she would have been regarded as simply a tragic figure for losing two babies. By the time her first son died, SIDS was declining, but still a widely given cause of death. By the time her second son died, thinking had progressed further, and any pathologist in the land would take into account the full circumstances of the case. The cause of death actually given was that the baby had been shaken, and this reflected the topicality of shaken baby syndrome at that time. Overall, the case revealed our deep, new suspicion of mothers when their babies died suddenly. Her successful appeal may have reflected a public reconsideration of that level of suspicion. In fact, although the pathologist involved certainly made errors of recording and disclosure, the medical evidence was extremely complex and controversial, and huge numbers of experts lined up to disagree with each other in court on almost every aspect of both children's deaths. The truth in the Clark case, as in so many, proved to be not solid, but a rather unpredictable liquid. The courts wanted honesty and truth, and then chose to be selective and make their own assessments of highly complex medical issues. No one emerged unscathed from the tragedy of the Clark case. For forensic pathologists, it was certainly a horrible reminder of the huge responsibilities of our profession.